Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, May 16th. The homeless point in time count is up, so what are we to do about it? We hear from the governor. And could parking be part of the housing solution? It's a tantalizing thought and the subject of a talk later tonight. We'll give you a preview. We paid paradise, put up a parking lot, the price of free parking. And we hear about conflict brewing behind the selection of a new caretaker of Mana'ala, the royal mausoleum in Nu'uanu. And higher education on the friendly aisle, what paths Moloka'i's bright young minds are taking to build their community up. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. As we heard in the headlines, our homeless numbers are up by 12% over last year and about the same as 2018. That's according to the annual point in time count. Governor Josh Green talked with us this morning about the long view in tackling our homeless and housing crisis. But before we get to that, he has just signed an emergency proclamation because of the widespread flooding we are seeing with this unusual weather. Here's Green.
Well, the rain is very serious, so we are getting between 6 and 8 inches of rain in different bands across our state. So because we just had heavy rains less than a week ago, we know there will be some flooding and some landslides, and I like to be out ahead of problems when I can be. So this is an opportunity to get a little bit more resource with the National Guard and whoever else is needed into communities. So they asked me last night, and I was happy to use our emergency rules.
Yes. And, you know, with this weather, the way it is, it's a terrible time to be out on the streets. And we just had the latest snapshot from the point in time count. What do you want to say about our situation?
Well, it's always tragic to still have homeless in our community because they suffer and they struggle, and then society struggles and suffers. The numbers are virtually identical to what they were in 2018. So this 5 to 6 year period has shown a very flat number, which means that we have more work to do than ever. Since the point in time count in January, we've actually launched 7 kauhale, and between now and the end of 2025, we will have over 20 kauhale, which are the small villages where people can get a tiny home, in place. The goal is to have them in every region, so we spread out the work, spread out the need, and we care for people. This will mean 1,400 to 1,700 extra places for individuals to go and live and be safe and get transitioned to permanent housing. The project should work. It also requires help in the form of more social workers and nurses and doctors. And that's why we're doing simultaneously the HELP program, repaying the loans of those who go into healthcare, especially if they're helping those who are really struggling. So this is the plan. This is the model to address social health. And it has worked. We're decreasing the cost of people who have been chronically homeless. About 500 additional people who are chronically homeless more than a year have come off of the streets. But the truth is there are more people struggling. You know, during COVID, the numbers dropped a little bit because we had some rent subsidies that we could put out to people. So we were paying $2,000 or $4,000 at different times to just cover people's rent so they didn't become homeless. But now that the pandemic is done and there aren't extra federal resources, we're back to essentially a similar number. Like I said, it was only different by one from 2018. This will be my decade to take on this problem, I expect, and I hope to have that opportunity because I think we're seeing big transformative changes in our approach. It's just going to take time to get all these villages built.
Well, you know, I just went back and looked at your State of the State address, and I don't know, my sense is that the Kahale project, you know, it's a good concept, and you know, it may surprise people initially when it pops up, but you know, you are serving a need where the need is great.
Thank you. Yes, sometimes it gives people a little surprise that you would actually just give people tiny homes in their backyard. But truth be told, that same number of people will be lingering on the street corner or in the park, and so we make a point of putting a fence, both symbolic and functional, around a kauhale that is nice and clean and gives people a sense of community on the inside. And a sense of understanding that we are serious about helping people get services inside the confines of the Kahale. And I think it will work. Just to tell people again also what happens, if an individual is on the street, their average cost is $8,192 for healthcare and all the needs that they have. If they're in a tiny home, it drops down to under $2,000 because they're getting care right there and the services are built in. So for every individual that gets into a tiny home, first of all, they're healthier. They don't use nearly as much drug or alcohol. And $6,000 less each month, which is 72 grand a year, isn't necessary to care for them at that corner and in the ER and so on. So it is good. We're projecting savings of $500 million between now and 2033. But also those monies can then be used to actually house people and get people off the streets. So I'm very optimistic about this. We're now building them. As you know, this is no joke. We actually have launched 7 of them in just the last few months, and they've been working, but it is, you know, it's a lot of hard work. And I'm so grateful to John Mizuno, my chief of staff, Brooke, everybody who's working on this, because Hawaii County's going to have them. If you want, I'll rattle a couple of them off just so people know.
Sure.
So Kahuiki Village, wonderful work by Duane Carrizo back in the day. Then we started one in Waimanalo with Auntie Blanche. We have now one in Kapolei, Kamaoku. As you know, the Hawaii Public Housing Authority is going to be a big deal in Liliha. Middle Street is opened. That's Ho'okahi Leo. I don't expect people to remember all the Hawaiian names. We've opened one in Kalihi. Waikiki Vistas is open now. Iwalei is opened. We're opening another one, Iwalei Center, because there's so many people there that need it. Cedar Church is coming in Kalihi. U.S. Veterans in Waianae, as you saw, there are big numbers over there. Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility will get one. And then on Maui, there'll be 3. Kauai will have 1 at least. And Big Island will have 3, including 2 in Hilo and 1 in Kona. So that the method here is to set it up so that in any community, it's a small number of tiny homes, not an overwhelming project that people can get at any time. So the homeless can have some services immediately, so that the program that Mayor Blangiardi has done, which is terrific, the CORE program with our physician friend over there, that's Jim Ireland, if they do what they need to do, and they will, which is drop individuals off at these facilities, the bed will be there in real time. That's how you solve this problem, just grinding it out, doing a lot of good hard work. And over time, as people recover, we even hope to offer modest paid jobs, you know, near minimum wage, but modest jobs, so the people themselves can manage their own Kahale community. And that is obviously good, because then they have means to live. So it's all a big lift. I think Hawaii can be the first state to decrease its homeless population by half over the course of a 5-year period. We're flat now. I've only had a year to do this. I would hope to see significant improvements over the next, say, 18 months, just because these Kahale are open, and it would be shocking if every bed didn't get filled.
Well, you know, you talked about the ER situation, you know, with the emergency rooms getting clogged, you know, with calls, and, you know, things are very tight right now. And so if you can divert some of those people that, you know, Dr. Jim Ireland, you know, those cases that his folks are responding to, I mean, it just helps everybody.
It does. 30%. I don't know if people understand this. I've said it a few times, maybe a few million times, but 30% of all the ER visits we have statewide have been individuals who are homeless. So, you know, if you go in there with a kidney stone or a gastrointestinal bleed or a stroke or something, it's very likely that someone is just revolving daily through the ER just because they had nowhere else to go. And that's not good healthcare. You know, that's my background, of course, as an ER doc until I became governor. And it's not the way to run a system. The average emergency room visit is well over $4,000 per visit, whereas I can give people full wraparound care for a couple months for that. So it's, you know, it's pretty logical. I apologize for using logic as a governor. I know that that's unusual in this country, but I'm going to keep doing it. And I think that this will make a very big difference. And honestly, if it doesn't make enough of a difference, we'll adjust. That's the way we're approaching things. We do have to get a lot more people into the workforce. And I know I keep mentioning this, but if there's anyone out there listening and they are a social worker or a nurse or a physician or clinical care worker of any kind, we will repay your medical debt, your loans, if you commit to working for 2 years or more in Hawaii, and you care for those who are in need, like homeless families. So apply to the HELP program through JABSM. AHEC, A-H-E-C, is the technical program. That means we'll have enough workforce so people who are social workers not making a lot of money can afford to stay and live and work here in Hawaii, and we can keep funding the Kauhale. Expect me to, you know, to extend the funding for Kauhale and for the HELP program in the coming budget next year. And let me just say this, mahalo also to the legislature. They really helped me out a lot on the Maui recovery, which also left a lot of people in very tenuous housing states. Much of the money that we're doing there is to prevent thousands of people from becoming homeless. So it all does tie together kind of in this ohana we have here in Hawaii. And I'm grateful to everybody who is helping us through these problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough thing to tackle, you know, particularly with the mental health needs. You know, we've had some really pretty shocking cases of violence on the street, you know, that's due to mental health, you know, or drug abuse, you know, and those chronic cases are really the tough ones to deal with.
Yes, they are the toughest. I'm so glad you mentioned that. The that's why one of the bright successes of this particular report, though the report just is meant to be honest and telling of the whole circumstance, but getting chronically homeless individuals off the street who usually have PTSD or bipolar or schizophrenia, it's very common. Those guys getting into HELP means that there's a lot less in the way of tragedy on the street. However, we saw a couple tragic moments on the streets. And, you know, just so I'm being clear, as a governor, we also saw some tragic moments in the households. We lost that beautiful family in Manoa.
Yes.
Because people are wrestling with existential problems and mental health problems. And I will give it my all every day for the 4 years I'm governor and longer if people keep me here to work on the trauma that people have dealt with between COVID and Maui and just a lot of traumas that are out there in the, you know, in society. So that's how we approach things. We did declare Hawaii a trauma-informed state. It means we give a little extra resource to deal with mass trauma and mass concerns like that. And we were the first state to do it. Other states are now going to follow us, it looks like. So there's just a lot of amazing people doing work in this field. But I do want people to understand it's going to be slow because it's one person by one person, one family by one family to get them into a better spot in life. And over time, people will see a big difference.
Well, we have seen just here in Honolulu, you know, the city's been able to manage, you know, a lot of those encampments, like right across from the convention center, you know, they got that cleaned up. I know they still have issues over there by the Department of Agriculture. I understand they've got a private security company that is helping because I believe someone did set fire in their front door and, you know, you can't have that happen. So you've got to be able to, you know, break up some of these larger encampments.
Totally. And that is important. And our goal is when we break up encampments and people make moves to remove debris and these large tents and so on, that in general, we move people to a tiny home, a kauhale, and we help them through their issues. And that's the very best approach. That's what we're going to keep trying to do. It will not be perfect, but on the flip side, we can't have any violence against anyone, including and of course, most importantly, innocent individuals who are not anywhere near these challenges. They have to be safe. So it's a lot of work. I'm grateful to the police who do so much work on this. I'm certainly overwhelmed by the work that Partners in Care and Partners in Health, I should say, do. It is really, it's really heartfelt work, but it's not easy. And there are easier jobs out there that pay better in many cases. So those who work in these fields and wrestle with the homeless crisis deserve a little extra appreciation. And that's kind of why I'm helping to repay their training debt and so on to make it a little easier to attract people into the field.
Yes, we definitely need the workforce development aspect in many sectors in our economy. And Governor, you know, this is all part and parcel of our housing crisis. And yes. I know there's a lot of effort being done, you know, obviously with the Maui housing issues as well. Anything you want to say on that front?
As of this morning, We peaked at 3,071 households in the hotels. It's now down to 519. That's 83% down from peak.
Wow.
We have teed up 1,181 transitional houses that we are either acquiring or building. That includes 175 at this place called Hagai, the Fed doing 169, the county doing 50. We have 450, and then there are other projects that are brewing. So we will build this transitional housing out. We signed legislation immediately that the legislature gave us to pull back on short-term rentals that are either illegal or should not have ever been grandfathered in. That's 7,000 short-term rentals on Maui, assuming that goes forward well. That's, you know, 7,000 homes that we can put people in or local people can rent soon. Big deal there. And that's one of the things. The tragedy is of course, spurred us to build faster and need to use emergency rules to build at all on Maui. But we now are going to have major reform on the short-term rental industry so that local families can get those, what amounts to, you know, it's like well over 30,000 short-term rentals back into local families' hands that were all owned by mainlanders who just were making a big profit. So it's a big process. We're really focused on the illegal ones, but we're also trying to get housing back into people's hands. And then I'm still under emergency rules to build.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a believer that we should build along the rail and that we should build a couple small cities along the rail so that people can jump on that rail and stay out of traffic and have starter homes. You know, it's all part of this move that we're making to make Hawaii more affordable. That's why the big, big, big tax break, which maybe we'll talk about in about 3 weeks when I sign that bill, and then more housing. We do those two things, and I address the social challenge of homelessness. I think we're going to be well off, and Maui will recover.
And that was Governor Josh Green, who we spoke to just within the past hour. We were covering the latest homeless numbers and the efforts to provide more affordable housing across the state, including Maui.
Hey there, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look into the world's biggest stories. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday at 1:30 here on HPR One.
Each of us is the star in the movie of our life. But how much of a role do we play in other people's movies?
It was a really sort of palpable fear that they were going to reject me, or worse, say something mean. I don't even know what, but I expected them to say something terrible.
The unseen pressures we place on other people, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering guided nature adventures on Hawaii Island designed to help inspire connection and stewardship of the land. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
Could parking play a part in our housing problem and housing solution? Well, that is something to ponder. Parking complaints have long topped the city's list when taxpayers called to grumble about something. It actually spurred the first parking permit program in one neighborhood in Kalihi. But the problem is much bigger than we think. It is the subject of a New York best-selling book entitled Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. Author Henry Grabar is the featured guest in the University of Hawaii's Better Tomorrow Speaker Series. His talk tonight at the UH Manoa campus is to examine planning policies around parking. He sat down with us this morning.
The title of my book is Paved Paradise, and that comes from a lyric of the Joni Mitchell song Big Yellow Taxi, which she wrote about the experience of being in Hawaii and feeling like nature was making way for more infrastructure for cars. And I chose that title for my book both because I think it's a great and beautiful line, but also because I think it recalls both the experience of seeing automobile infrastructure take nature's place, right, and destroy things in its wake, but also maybe the idea that actually that's what so many of us have, the way we've designed our society, that's what we've designed our society to deliver, which is exactly all this pavement, right? I mean, it's not by accident. It's very much something that we decided that we wanted to replace all this natural land. And I think that in the end was a mistake, as Joni recognized.
I'm assuming you're going to go to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and check out that parking lot while you're here.
Naturally, a pilgrimage, right?
Yes, yes, of course. Yes, and our tree museum as well.
Yes.
Well, you know, here in Hawaii, we've got some idiosyncrasies when it comes to parking. We like to back our cars into our spaces for some strange reason. You will notice that if you're here for any length of time. And yes, we do have a love-hate relationship with our cars. And when it comes to parking and free parking in particular, access to beaches is very important to us. And so anytime the state or the city wants to put in meters and charge for parking, there's pushback from the community because they see free access to the beach as an important part of living on an island. So I don't know how that jives with your whole premise of your book.
Yeah, it's a complicated question, to be sure. We've developed a society in which you basically need to have a car to go around and do the things that life demands. And I think that is fundamentally unfair. It's a tax on our daily existence that we are required to spend hundreds of dollars a month on car payments and insurance and gasoline and all the rest, just to be able to go to work, see our friends, visit the beach, et cetera. And so the issue of free parking, right, it means access for people. It means being able to visit something. But on this, at the same time, when the parking is free, it tends to fill up really quickly because people, when things are free, they will use that resource in a way that maybe, you know, there's the issue of supply and demand, right? Like if the price is free, people will consume lots and lots of that resource. And that's what you see with parking, right? When you make parking free, you find that people will, they'll drive more, they'll park for longer amounts of time, and they'll drive in separate cars. And so the idea of paying for parking, it's the idea is not to sock it to the motorist, right? Or restrict people's access to the beach, but simply a small nudge in the direction of driving together so that that limited parking resource at the beach can serve more people. And that's really the goal. And to serve more people without the alternative, right? Which is just demolishing more and more natural land to build more parking lots.
Right. So carpool people, right? I mean, I know when we do have those free spaces near the beach, one complaint we hear is that the hotel workers who go into Waikiki, that they will park there at the beach park because it's free. You know, they're not at the top of the pay scale. And they're trying to save money. And and I just had a conversation with someone yesterday about, you know, if you know all the tricks of where to park in Waikiki, because Waikiki is pretty congested, it can be a much better experience rather than driving around and cursing because you can't find any parking.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the employees because that was the original observation of the man who invented the parking meter. He was an Oklahoma City newspaper man, and he looked out his window and he saw that all the spots on their little main street were full of employees who got there first thing in the morning, parked for free, and left their car there for 10 hours. And that meant that when people showed up to have lunch or go to a meeting or buy something in a shop, they found there was no parking available to them. And so his solution was, let's implement this small charge just to make sure that these employees park a little further away and we leave these prime spots available to people. And so when you think about free versus paid parking, free parking is free, but it's often not available. Right. And that's the trade-off you make. And that sometimes means lots more traffic because cars circling and circling looking for a spot. And again, it has this determinative effect on the way people travel because people do decide to drive alone and drive when the parking is free. And we found that basically one of the, you know, the top nudge you can make to encourage people to carpool, use transit, walk, bike, et cetera, is to put a small charge on that parking. And again, make sure that this resource is actually available when you need it. Right. And I think for a lot of people, that's just as important as having free parking, because free parking is no good if you get there and there's no place to park.
During the pandemic, we watched something very weird happen where they took away our parking spaces for the grab and go. You know, you order ahead and someone comes out and gives you your merchandise. We also saw the creation of little parklets. They turned parking spaces into places where you could dine outside. And that was really kind of interesting. And some of those remain. Like in my neighborhood, there's one that's still up, or a couple actually. So it's kind of neat that it hasn't just reverted back to regular parking spaces.
Yeah, I witnessed that as well in New York, where I was living at the time. And it was such a seismic transformation in the way people thought about this public space, right? Because for so long, the edges of the street, we have just assumed that that's a place where people store their private property for free in the form of an automobile. Of course, you can't do that with any other private property. You can't use it as a mini storage unit, but we allow it for cars. And then all of a sudden, this realization that this space could be used for something else, I thought was pretty transformative in the way people thought about their streets, right? And it goes beyond restaurant seating, right? I mean, it's this realization that we have this enormous public asset. In many cities, the largest single public real estate holding is the streets. And so if you want to think about how we can make a city a better place to live, build public space, build bike lanes, bus lanes, stormwater infrastructure, plant trees, all that stuff, you have to consider this parking lane as maybe just a terrain that shouldn't just be reserved for storing cars.
Well, I remember the first time that the idea of getting a parking permit in your neighborhood arose its ugly head, because living in San Francisco, we had to have special decals if you lived in the neighborhood and you parked on the street. And even though it allowed you to park, you know, in front of your apartment building, you couldn't leave your car there for 2 days. So if you were going to go, you know, on a trip, you got to go park it in a paid garage. So when that happened here, it was like, whoa, you know, that's crazy that you have to get a permit in your own neighborhood just to park your car. And then the first time we got the apartment building with the stacked cars, you know, I think there's only one. I don't know how that's going. It's fairly new. But, you know, those ideas, you're just thinking, whoa, you know, what's possible when it comes to parking?
Yeah, I think, you know, for a long time, people love the idea, of course, of the free-for-all at the curb. This idea that, as you mentioned, it is this kind of egalitarian idea that everybody gets to park for free wherever they want in a society that feels increasingly divided up into the haves and the have-nots, where there's dynamic pricing for your Uber ride and restaurant reservation, the secondary market for restaurant reservations and all these things. And so people like that idea about parking. But the flip side of that, right, is that by clinging to parking above all else, you actually make it really difficult to achieve a lot of the things you want to achieve as a city. I mean, let's just take the giveaway of all this public space to the free storage of cars. I mean, even just charging a small amount for the parking, not only does it help organizationally, right? It frees up space and makes sure that when you arrive, there is a space for you to park, but it also creates a source of money for the neighborhood, for public improvements, right? And so that's how you get money for stormwater infrastructure and beach improvements and all that stuff, and ultimately maybe even mass transit, so that access to the beach is not actually contingent on being able to drive there by yourself, but is a more widely shared right that doesn't require owning a car first.
The other quirky thing about Hawaii is that we have a lot of unimproved areas, you know, that don't have curbs and are not up to city standards. So lots of people park in those places where they shouldn't be parking. And, you know, over the years, the number one complaint with the city is parking issues in your neighborhood. You know, you've got vacation rental units, illegal units popping up, and then you have, you know, lots of tourists coming in with rental cars. You have Turo. We watched Turo blossom in some neighborhoods, and that really made people very, very upset because they're, you know, running businesses, you know, on a public resource. So, yeah, lots of neighborhoods were up in arms over that.
Right.
But I don't know what you see when you travel to different places. You know, is it pretty much the same everywhere?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think when you talk about the parking problem in Honolulu, you're talking about a good type of parking problem, which is to say lots of people want to be here and they want to be in these places. And that's, from an urban planning perspective, a good problem to have, because the opposite type of parking problem is one where you have actually destroyed lots and lots of the urban and natural landscape to create parking lots. And then you no longer have a parking problem, but you have a different type of problem, right? Which is that you've destroyed a lot of the things that people came to visit in the first place. And there's no shortage of natural destinations where there has been so much parking built that you get there and you feel like you're not really in nature. You're actually just at the edge of a giant parking lot. And so to some extent, I think Honolulu suffers from a parking problem that it has in common with a lot of older and more densely built cities on the mainland. And the solution to that really is to sort of try and rein in the free-for-all that's happening at the curb. The complaints you're talking about, those are complaints that are designed to be addressed with a parking permit program, right? Because then you can begin to say, okay, who does this space belong to? And how do we distribute it? And how much should you pay for the right to store your car there? And I think your answer to that question may be, I should pay $0 because I already pay taxes. But then again, there's lots of people who don't drive and don't own cars, and they pay taxes too. And so I think once you begin to institute a system of permits, you gain a right to organize that space, right? And you begin to eliminate maybe some of the discretionary parking that's happening, people who park on the curb but could be parked in their home garage, right? And I think that should be advantageous for everybody because it frees up more room.
And then in your research, did you find anything unusual? I don't know, like in Europe, you know, some other part of the globe where they're doing things differently that maybe we could learn from?
Well, a lot of places have realized that free parking is like a fertility drug for cars. So the more free parking you have, the more people are going to own cars and the more people are going to drive them. And so if your goals as a city are to have less traffic, to have less pollution, to have more people biking, using transit, et cetera, then free parking is really the place to focus on if you want to make changes in that realm, right? And so when you go to European cities, you'll find it's almost beyond a point of comparison because their public transit systems are so robust, right? But they have realized at least that free parking, it's a lever, right? And you can mess with that from a policy perspective and encourage changes in the way people get around in a way that at the end winds up being really positive because you do have a city that winds up being greener, with less traffic, where it's actually easier for people to get from A to B, even if that means they're not getting there in a car.
Any final thoughts just about parking and where you think we should be headed?
Well, I think the most important thing with parking is that it's sort of the flip side of the housing question. When you think about the affordability question in housing, it's often connected to transportation, right? Housing is sort of the flip side of transportation. And so we want to be able to build lots more housing so that people can move into their own apartments. So you know that rent is a problem here as it is in many other cities. And to be able to build that housing, we need to build it in places where people are going to move in and they're not going to own more cars, right? Because our streets are a limited resource. We can't build any more space on the streets. So we need to be doing everything we can to allow new people to move in, but make sure that those people will be less likely to drive than they would have been otherwise. And I think parking is the key there, right? Less parking means more affordability, and it also means more new neighbors and more new businesses without more traffic.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time here, and we're going to chew on this.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
That was Henry Grabar, author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. Can rethinking our parking policies help with housing? He is a writer for the online magazine Slate, and he's a Loeb Fellow at the Harvard School of Design. Grabar will be at the University of Hawaii tonight as part of the A Better Tomorrow speaker series. His free talk starts at 6:30 in the Architecture Auditorium.
Put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot.
The Royal Mausoleum in Nu'uanu is steeped in history. It is the resting place of Hawaii's ali'i, and for years, the kuleana, the responsibility for caring for it, rested with one family. But that may be about to change. HPR's Kuve Hirishi joins us to talk about this. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Yes, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, DLNR Director Don Chang, is meeting today with leaders of various Hawaiian organizations over concerns about the selection of a new curator for the Mauna Ala Royal Mausoleum.
Yeah, they announced this this week, and you were going to talk to her today.
We had media availability scheduled yesterday up at Mauna Ala for Donnie Chong, who was recently chosen by DLNR to become the next curator for Mauna Ala, but at the last minute, that was canceled, and this meeting is taking place today. So we'll see what comes of it, and we'll talk more about sort of what the contention is there. But going back to the history, as you mentioned, the Mauna Ala Royal Mausoleum has been the resting place of Hawaiian ali'i, or royalty, since 1865. This 3.5-acre site in Nu'uanu, adjacent to the Oahu Cemetery, is home to more than 50 ali'i and trusted advisors from the Kamehameha and Kalakaua lineage. At the time, the idea of disclosing the location of one's remains, at least for Native Hawaiians, was a fairly new practice. Traditionally, Hawaiians laid their kupuna to rest in secret because the bones, or iwi, contained the spirit of their kupuna and needed to be protected. This practice is often described in a popular Mo'olelo or story of Kamehameha I and the hiding of his Iwi in a cave, the exact location of which remains a secret. But he had entrusted this kuleana to a handful of people, most notably his close trusted advisor, Ho'olulu. Kimo Alama Keolana shares the story that's been passed down through the generations of this ultimately successful mission to hide Kamehameha's Iwi. Keolana's ancestor, Kukanalua, was actually a part of this entourage.
My kupuna was the one who was designated and chosen by Kamehameha I to secure the cave in which he was going to be interred. And so he found that cave and he physically and spiritually cleaned it. He put in Kamehameha's personal effects into the cave, including his canoe. He made it ready for Ho'olulu. So Ho'olulu was designated as the one to carry the bones. And it was Ho'opili and Keopuolani that took Ho'olulu to the site where Kamehameha's bones were to be laid to rest. And so when they were taken to the cave, he gave the bones to Kukanaloa, and together Ho'olulu and Kukanaloa put the bones of Kamehameha into its proper place, into the cave.
So when Mauna Ala was established, right, some 40 or 50 years later, the ali'i from the Kamehameha line, who were in power at the time, entrusted descendants of Ho'olulu and Ho'opili, who successfully entered Kamehameha Nui's Iwi, to serve as kahu or curators of the royal mausoleum. And this would make sense because, you know, this allows the traditions, chants, and protocols to sort of be passed down generation to generation. But I think more importantly, the ali'i had established trust with these particular ohana that they would be cared for. A majority of the 15 curators who have served at Mauna Ala since 1865 were descendants of Ho'olulu, and you mentioned that earlier. These include generations of the Bekli, Kahea, Taylor, and Mayoho families, and the most recent kahu there, the Mayoho family, for three generations now, since 1966. But that tradition continued even after DLNR took over jurisdiction of Mauna Ala back in the mid-1960s. The Mayohos have remained the curators there. And DLNR announced, as we mentioned earlier this week, that it was kind of breaking with tradition by selecting the curator without known genealogical ties to or training under these previous kahu or families. And this prompted leaders of the royal societies and civic clubs to call for a meeting with DLNR. In my conversations with some of these leaders, the issue appears to have less to do with the chosen kahu itself as much as the selection process, which they say they were left out of. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs also confirmed it was not consulted on this. And, you know, when we ask what the selection process was like for the curator position, DLNR said in an emailed statement that, you know, it's just exactly the same one used for hiring all state employees, following normal practices and rules. And that might be the pain point in conversations today at this meeting, right? DLNR trying to make the point that they trying to tick all the state employee boxes, and Native Hawaiian leaders saying there's more to consider than what's on that checklist. Keolana was one of the four finalists for the position, along with Kumuhula, Frank Kawaika Bokalani Hewitt, and James Mayoho, whose family, interestingly enough, has held the kahu title at Mauna Ala as long as DLNR has had jurisdiction over it. But Keolana trained under Bekli Kahea and Mayoho Ohanas and served Princess Abigail Kawananakua until her death. So he was initially surprised by the choice, but says, you know, it's a tough position to fill, especially if you don't understand all that history that we just went through.
Don't understand. As a matter of fact, in my interview, I had told them things about Mauna Ala that they did not even know. But I think they don't understand what the characteristics or qualities of a kahu are. And I think those would be pretty hard things to put in a job description. I mean, you know, you kind of put kahu must know these required oli. The kahu must, you know, huli morning, noon, and night. You know, the appropriate phrase in English and Hawaiian.
So DLNR, as I mentioned, did choose Donnie Chong as its next curator for Mauna Ala. Chair Chang said in that news release that, you know, it was Donnie's balance of experiences, perspectives and cultural connections to Mauna Ala, as well as her keen understanding of the unique and varied role of the curator position that set her apart. I know Chong has been a member of at least one royal society, the Kahumanu Society, who has supported her taking this position, but her connections to Mauna Ala are not publicly known. So we were hoping to get a sense of that, as I mentioned earlier in the press conference yesterday, but that did not happen.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it today if DLNR just does backpedal and, you know, but there are, I understand some, you know, cultural considerations that these groups would have liked.
Right. And but and then another point to make, I think, in terms of facilities management. So Mauna Ala falls under the parks division there with DLNR. And in years past, I can think like back in 2004, that place was not being well kept. And so all the Ali'i trusts who have Ali'i buried in this Maroa Mausoleum gotten together, raised some funds, and really kind of renovated that. And I think that may be part of what they're hoping the new curator will have strong skills in, to make sure they're doing that on top of the cultural stuff. So we'll see what comes out of that meeting.
Yeah, very interesting time, and be interesting to see what the future holds for Mauna Ala and the new curator. But thank you so much, Kuuwe. That was HR's Kuuwe Hiraishi, who joined us to talk about the flap over the new curator for the Mauna Ala Royal Mausoleum in Nu'uanu. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
To tell you to buckle up, it's going to be difficult. You guys are ready for it. I need to say this in other parts of the state, but it's going to be a crazy run the next 6 months.
Arizona's Senate race. It could decide the fate of the Senate. It will also say a lot about the national appetite for Trumpism in 2024. So we'll take a close look at what's unfolding in Arizona. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
The thing about sheep is that you can't make them not grow wool, hence an ever-growing supply.
I was able to get enough money from that wool that I could pay for their winter feed. Today, I can't even pay for half the shearing.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Baba Black Sheep indeed. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
The University of Hawaii graduated thousands of students this weekend, and the Friendly Isle held commencement ceremonies for the first time in 8 years. HR's Catherine Kulit-Pachtel joins us this morning. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
So explain this. 8 years?
Yes. Yeah, so the UH Maui College Molokai Education Center normally holds commencement ceremonies every 4 years. And the last in-person commencement was held in 2016 because it was scheduled for 2020. And of course, COVID pandemic threw a wrench in everyone's plans during that time. And so it was delayed. They did hold a drive-through ceremony in 2021, but of course it's just not the same as in-person. So this was a really big celebration for the island, for the 42 Molokai graduates who participated in that commencement as well. And they received degrees and certifications ranging from dental hygiene, education, Hawaiian studies, construction technology. Someone received their master's in curriculum studies. There are also a number of nurse aid graduates who received their certification. And that nearly doubled the number of certified nurse aides since the last Molokai commencement. And that really fills a big need on the island for healthcare services. So that is, you know, a really big contribution to the community. And 23 students earned that nurse aid certification, 9 of which were high school students who will also be receiving their high school diploma soon. So, you know, celebrating so much in the educational field.
That's terrific.
And we also had the first ever doctoral graduate to be hooded at a Molokai commencement. So hooding is a traditional sort of ceremonial gesture for those receiving their doctorate degree. And Pulama Lima is from Molokai. She earned her PhD in anthropology from UH Manoa. And she chose to celebrate here on Molokai instead of at UH Manoa. She said, you know, the shortage in flights, the expense of flights, and just wanting to celebrate here with her family and community where they could attend and be part of that celebration made her want to do it here on the island. Lima talked about what led her to anthropology.
I went to school for Hawaiian Studies and Hawaiian Language at University of Hawaii at Hilo to pursue a degree in Hawaiian Studies. And then I took a course in anthropology and just sort of fell in love with everything that the field encompassed. You know, it was exactly what I was interested in, the study of cultures, of people, and then was totally blown away when I took a cultural resource management course by Dr. Peter Mills at UH Hilo. And it really opened up my eyes to cultural resource management, wahi kupuna stewardship, and how there's such a lack of Native Hawaiian representation in that field, and how critical it was to have, you know, indigenous voices in the field of archaeology, because, you know, these are folks that archaeologists sort of write the histories of our people and how, and it perpetuates that narrative, right? So that was one aspect of it. Also the aspect of development and seeing the destruction of sites all throughout Hawaii and effect, especially on our iwi kupuna or our ancestral human remains.
Wow, so thoughtful, you know, and she found her passion there.
She did. So she has a background in Hawaiian language and, of course, Hawaiian studies. When I asked her about what made her, what makes her want to, you know, feel like pursuing a higher degree is important, she said, why wouldn't you? You know, it opens so many doors. You don't have to stick to the career path sort of defined by your degree. It really just opens up this wide field. And for her, of course, in anthropology, it also is important for credentialing in that field, really gives her that legitimacy to practice what she's so passionate about. And she did this all while raising young kids. And also, she's executive director of Ka'ipu Makani Cultural Heritage Center here on Molokai, which does a lot of work in the community. So she says family and community support is really what got her through this, you know, really long, of course, process of the PhD accomplishment. Kelly Dudwa is a site coordinator at UH Maui College Molokai, and she explained a shift that they've seen in higher education on Molokai in recent years.
We are prioritizing work areas where we have workforce shortages. So looking ahead, looking at what's happening now, but also looking ahead at what we project to be the jobs of the future for Molokai, trying to work closely with industry folks to determine what those credentialing pathways are. And before, I think we used to be a lot more focused on credit programming, so how we design curriculum, certificates, and degrees on the credit side of the house. And through the pandemic, we've realized that a lot of employers and students are interested in non-credit programming. And so we're really building up that side of our course offerings and starting to do more in that area just to fill all these areas where we're seeing workforce need. We'll always continue to offer a strong liberal arts program, which is the first 2 years to most four-year pathways, right? And so that's really our bread and butter. That's what we will continue to do well. But this expansion is looking at more of short-term certificates that people can earn and take directly to the workforce, or for people that are in the workforce to upskill, to add new credentials to their tool belts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, lots of effort is being put toward, you know, developing our workforce.
For sure, really, really community building at its core. And they are offering classes like forklift training and, you know, Hawaiian language, medical assisting. They have a medical assisting cohort, nurse aid, even CDL classes. So really a wide variety of options here at, you know, right on Molokai, so folks don't have to travel for it. Lima talked about Molokai's cultural traditions. I thought that was really interesting, looking at the history and the island's traditions of becoming an expert in your field.
Traditionally and historically, Molokai was famed for our kahuna. And everyone thinks of kahuna as, you know, they equate it with priests or, you know, really religious affiliations. But the way that, at least in our mo'olelo here on Molokai, the term kahuna was interpreted meant expert. And so we had so many schools, kahuna schools on Molokai, so much so and so well done that people from the different islands would come to Molokai so that they could study under our kahuna. And they would become experts in different practices, whether it be astronomy, medicine, architecture, what have you. And then they would go back to their own communities to start their own schools. And so Molokai was famed for that, right? And we had this expectation and this huge reputation of being experts in practice. And especially for me, somebody who appreciates history and culture and identity, that's sort of the message that I want our community and students to remember, right, is that we are part of this larger lineage and mo'oku'ohau of experts. And it resides in us and it lives in us. And all we have to do is tap into that ancestral mana, I would say, you know, that ancestral wisdom to really invoke and elevate that knowledge. It's innate already within us to do so. So just to act upon it is what I would say to those interested in higher education.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful.
It is, for sure. And, you know, the college serves such a place in our community here on Molokai of fostering that higher education and continuing those traditions, you know, especially lately through workforce development and community building.
Yeah, well, thank you for this story. Very eye-opening. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel talking with us about the new college graduates from Molokai and what that means for their community. That does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we are planning a show featuring young voices, our keiki, stepping out and making us proud. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.